all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
And welcome once again to Coolarity Radio right here in Coolarity. Coolarity LLC. Wham! WAAM, 1600 AM on your dial, that's right. Coming to you from the Garden Spot of the Midwest, Ann Arbor, Michigan, that's right. And this is where it all happens, right here. And with me today is my partner, Dale.
Good afternoon, Bob. How you doing?
Oh, it is afternoon. And we are live, by the way. And folks, remember, whenever you're listening to this program, you're always going to want to have a...
pencil and a piece of paper.
Crayon, pencil, whatever, paintbrush, because we always have so much good stuff, and we do have something today. We have an author with us, Mr. Frank Lampe, who wrote Ghost Riders. Ooh. Ghost Riders, a war story, and I see the 101st Airborne emblem on there, but oh, it's going to be great. So we're going to be talking about that, and I also have somebody back from my childhood, Mr. Mike Updike. He'll be with us in just a moment, and of course, Dale. This is going to be all about Vietnam stories, things that you want to hear and know.
Some things you don't want to hear and
ooh.
Know.
Perhaps. The sensors are off, folks. That's right.
Well, Dale, make sure Derek's got his finger on the button.
That's, oh, yeah. What do we have, 5-second delay? Right, something like that. Okay. 30. Oh, okay. All right. Let's talk about congressmen. We have tomorrow long-term care. And by the way, folks, if you have something that you'd like for us to mention on air, please, please let us know. Go to veteransradio.net, and there's all that information, how to contact us.
Just click on contact us, and you can, and we'll get the message.
Get it on the air, right. Okay. And find out about these things. But there, those of you within the sound of our voice here in Washtenaw County, there's long-term care veterans, all about long-term care. It's going to be tomorrow at 11 o'clock at the Pittsfield Township Senior Center, 11 o'clock tomorrow, Monday, June 29th, and it's all about long-term care. You're also going to want to go on Tuesday. It's going to be in Troy, Taylor, Michigan. So long-term care, that's for Wayne County people. Washtenaw County folks is going to be at the Pittsfield Township. And in Wayne County, it's at the Ford Senior Center. Oh, here we are in Taylor, Michigan. We got to get off Taylor.
I was going to say, where in Pittsfield Township is the Senior Center?
At the township office. Platton, Ellsworth.
Oh, Platton,
Ellsworth.
Michigan Ave.
Nope.
Right?
Ellsworth.
Okay.
Yeah. No, Michigan Ave, you're right.
Come on, you live right there.
I don't know, man. Too much rain.
Okay, so the Pittsfield Township offices are at the intersection of Platt and
Michigan
Avenue.
That's right.
Right across from a certain hamburger restaurant, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, one of those.
They're not one of our sponsors, so we're not going to promote them.
But do
them.
That, you know, because these things are, oh, man, what do I need to know all this for? Well, I'll tell you why. Because when it happens, in fact, one of our guests is a lawyer, right? He can verify the fact that you should always be prepared. So get that information. How does the Affordable Care Act work with long-term care and your veteran benefits? And anyway, it's all about that. And that's Congressman Debbie Dingell, who will be and always has been, along with John, her husband John, who just retired, the longest-serving congressman.
In the history of the world.
It was a 37 years, something like that. Dale, what do you got?
I've got a real good noisemaker here. The Yankee Air Museum Thunder Over Michigan is coming again at the end of August, August 29th and 30th, out at Willow Run at the Yankee Air Museum. The Blue Angels, right?
Yep.
Are going to be there this year, which is just an amazing precision jet flying team. You've got to go see
I've
this.
I've seen those guys.
Just, and women. Remember?
And women. Folks don't know emails, all right?
But anyway, August 29th and 30th, Willow Run Airport at the Yankee Air Museum.
Thunder Over, Michigan.
For more
Lots
information.
Of stuff to do. They have a great Great static displays.
Static displays. They're going to have a lot of different demonstrations. They've got World War II aircraft. You can catch rides on a B-17 or B-24. You can also, you're going to be seeing attacks by various different types of aircraft. World War II aircraft, Huey helicopters will be there. You can get a ride on a Huey. All kinds of aircraft.
Food.
And lots of food, of course.
And it is a family event.
A lot of displays there that are set up.
And ask them, honey, if there's plenty of bathrooms. Yeah, there is, man, so don't worry about that.
Not to worry. These guys are very, very well organized.
They got it together, that's right.
They got it together.
And women want to know that, right? And
they do.
They want to know about food for the kids and all that. They've got all that stuff. And places that you can observe the air show itself and all the other exhibitions without even getting out in the sun.
Absolutely. So make sure you go to YankeeAirMuseum.org for more information. You can buy your tickets there. If you buy them now, I believe you can get a little discount on them. And, hey, you know, when you're talking to them, tell them you heard about it on Veterans Radio.
That'd be a good thing. Well, here we go. Things are happening all over, and they're happening with Conway Truckload. You know, the other day I was watching television, and about the Navy, and to run a ship, you got to be a team. You really got to be a team. There's somebody that, well, I ain't doing that today. I mean, it all works that way, and that's what the service is all about. When I think about it, it created that teamwork, and that's what Conway Truckload is talking about when they have their hiring program for veterans. Join the team. Dale.
Absolutely. Hey, veterans, safe and hardworking over-the-road truck drivers deserve modern and well-maintained equipment they can count on. Conway Truckload has purchased over 500 new Kenworth T680s with twin-screw axle drives, whatever that is, automated manual transmission, and other features that improve handling and comfort. Take a virtual tour of the equipment on truetoblue.com/equipment. That's truetoblue.com. That's truetoblue.com/equipment. Speak to a recruiter and apply to drive for Conway Truckload by calling 866-WORK-FOR-US. That's 866, the word work, the number 4, and the U-S.
That's a great outfit to work for.
Yeah, they're a very, very high-class organization, very supportive of veterans, and this drive is, they've got a great driving program where you can make some money while you're learning to drive, while you're acting as a, almost like a Peter pilot in an aircraft. You get a lot of training and a lot of, you can make a lot of money.
I remember my mother saying, go to school or you'll wind up a truck driver. I remember that. I mean, mom, right?
Not such a bad deal right now.
I mean, we're talking six figures.
They are, it's one of the, I want to say the highest hiring occupations in the country right now. They need truck drivers. And if you're a veteran out there and you've got experience, you've already got your CDL license, or you were driving a deuce and a half.
And even if you don't have a license, you can get it with Conway Truckload.
They'll make sure you get the license. So contact them. Go to their website. That's truetoblue.com. That's true, the number 2, blue.com/equipment, if you want to check out all these Kenworth trucks.
And we'll be right back with Veterans Radio and all of our guests.
I got a letter from LBJ. It's said this is your lucky day. It's time to put your khaki trousers on. Though it may seem very clear, we've got no job to give you here, so we are sending you to Vietnam. Lyndon Johnson stole the nation. Have no fear of escalation. I am trying everyone to flee. Though it isn't really war, we're sending 50,000 more to help save Vietnam from Vietnamese. I jumped off the old troop ship and sank in.
That's right, folks. Vietnam, a section of time in our history, a time, an epoch lasting over 10 years. And I have one of the with me today, and that we're able to do. This is what Veterans Radio is all about, is tell the stories. And I have with me, in the studio with me, live, and the boys are right here, Mr. Mike Updike.
Hi.
U.S. Army. All right, I got to get him to get a little closer to the mic. And I was telling them, don't thump the table. That's all right. And Mr. Frank Lampe from the Army.
Good afternoon, Bob. Nice to be back.
And, of course, my friend and colleague, Dale Thronberry. We're going to talk today about Vietnam stories, not just political and not just combat, but all the little stuff that if you were having a beer with somebody and somebody would just want to ask you, like, gee, did when you're out in the field, did you take extra toilet paper or stuff like that? You know, and, yeah, that's what I'd ask. What the heck? I mean, you got to be prepared, right? And you don't know. You could be out there for weeks.
You got it.
Okay, so to get things started, I'm going to go to Dale first. Tell us about Brave Dave.
Oh, Brave Dave. Well, one of the things in flying a helicopter, whenever you would go into an LZ, especially if it was a hot LZ where people had a tendency to shoot at you, the idea was that the co-pilot or both of you would be on the controls just in case somebody got shot and the other pilot could take the controls and you wouldn't crash into that. And unfortunately, this particular officer, who was a young, relatively new pilot, and it wasn't me, so this didn't happen to me, but his aircraft commander took a round in the chest, hit his chicken plate, which is our armor plating that we wore, knocked his seat off the rails all the way back to the firewall. And so as he's flying through the wall, you know, toward the back of the aircraft, he's going, "You've got it." And unfortunately, Dave was a little bit scared that day, and he was off the controls, and so the aircraft is... I'm showing my hand. My wife's going to tell me, "Don't show your hands when you're telling a story." But is wobbling all over the place. And the crew chief jumped up, sat on the floor of the aircraft, and was able to fly it. And so shortly thereafter, Dave went to work in the maintenance platoon. No offense to the maintenance platoon, but that's where they sent him so that he wouldn't be on any missions any longer.
Wow, That was harrowing.
That's one of the reasons that we taught our crew chiefs and door gunners sometimes at least how to get the aircraft up and down, right, Frank?
Exactly, right. I got about almost 40 hours of stick time flying as a crew chief.
Did you get your wings?
No.
Did you want your wings?
Had a lot of fun. Well, my aircraft commander was actually a civilian flight instructor. And he was 2 years older than me, and, you know, kids that age, all you want to do is goof off anyway. And so the Peter pilots, the co-pilots, they'd want to shoot the machine gun, so we'd swap positions. He'd come back into my seat, and I'd go into his seat, and then we practiced takeoffs and straight and level.
Tell us about the Jesus nut. I love that term. Now, folks, we're cool with that. This was, I'm sure, the Army nomenclature was.
I couldn't even tell you the real name.
Cinch device, but the guys call it the Jesus nut. Tell us about that, Frank.
Well, Dale elaborated pretty good on it last time we talked about this, but the Jesus nut was the nut that held the entire main rotor system
in
place.
That was it.
Yeah. And it was a very secure nut, and
we're talking nut, folks. It's holding up the blade.
It was a aluminum cast aluminum cap that was probably about 4 inches in diameter.
Yeah, I think so.
And you'd screw it on, and then you would have they had teeth that you would actually screw the teeth in so that it wouldn't back off or unscrew. And the reason it became the Jesus nut is that if it did come off,
the guy would say,
"Oh Jesus!" Because that's the last thing was going to happen is that because that helicopter is going straight down.
I mean, as crew chief, you check that very often. Did you ever find it maybe slightly loose so that?
No, that's what those cogs.
Yeah,
those
cogs
were in place. The teeth to prevent it from backing.
We didn't find that loose. We found I call them the push-me-pull-me tubes, but the stabilizer bars, which would control the blades themselves, hope, as it says, stabilize the blades. And one time a Peter pilot of ours did a pre-flight inspection, and they were not attached. at the bottom. And I came down, one of the privileges of being an aircraft commander, I come down a little bit later than the other guys. And so I went through my little pre-flight real quickly and said, uh-oh. I said, you know, is the aircraft ready to go? And he goes, yes, sir, it's ready to go. And I said, well, what are we going to do with these guys? You know, and they're flapping back and forth. And he, because that would have prevented you from taking off also. So if they don't work, you don't get in the air.
Dale was a slick pilot. What's a slick?
A slick is a troop carrier, equipment carrier, animal carrier.
Sling?
Medevac carrier. Yeah, we would sling load stuff every once in a while. We carried pretty much anything you can imagine, from American troops to Vietnamese troops to wounded to dead to animals. I mean, sometimes
prisoners.
We would
lose. Prisoners?
POWs.
POWs.
We told that story the last time, POW story. And
some people weren't there on them. Tell it again.
The point is that we were, it was a utility helicopter, UH-1H model, utility helicopter, this model. They were all Bell helicopters, and the Army says that they have no more in service any longer, but there are still some branches that use souped-up versions, I guess you could say, of Hueys, and some foreign governments are still using a Huey.
I looked up a figure, and it said there was 1 million evac casualties during the Vietnam War, and that it was an hour travel time from the battleground to, I guess, a MASH unit. That's probably.
I would say it was less than that.
Yeah, I'd say like 20 minutes.
Max.
Yeah.
I mean, it's called the golden hour. And if you can get a wounded person to a MASH unit within an hour, the chances of them surviving are much higher.
Okay. Well, Nina's signaling something. Sure. Go ahead, Nina. Yeah, that's Jimmy Cliff, Vietnam. That, I think music, what I remember, and I wasn't in Vietnam, it was during the Vietnam era, so all that music was part of me, but boy, Frank, what the, some of the songs that we were going over in the green room just before. And
yeah, and I'm drawing a total blank now, but.
That happens nowadays.
When I was mentioning titles.
San Francisco. Well, San Francisco was, I was talking with Dale about it. You know, you could not listen to that song over there and not get weepy. I mean, it's just one of those things. Everybody, you know, when we left for Vietnam, we left from Oakland/San Francisco.
So it was I left my heart, not the one flowers in your hair.
Right, right.
Well, both of them were pretty powerful songs.
Yeah.
And what years were you in, Mike?
67. Well, for a long time, but Vietnam, 67 to 68.
Yeah, and by the way, I have to introduce Mike. He has a very special distinction. And what was that to say? I mean, seriously, folks, we get some great guests here on Veterans Radio.
Well, it's sort of one of those distinctions maybe you'd really not like to have, because at one point in my career, I was the longest-serving lieutenant colonel because they didn't get promoted to full colonel.
Right, but you were the oldest.
Yeah, probably.
Oldest-serving lieutenant colonel in the Army.
I believe that's true.
And is that when they sent you to Vietnam?
Oh, no. Oh. I was just a lieutenant back then.
What did the music mean to you?
Oh, a lot.
A wife?
No, I didn't even have a girlfriend.
Oh, okay. So
I had my parents and my dog back home, but that was it.
You said, okay, well.
Yeah, and
people like their pets, what
right.
can I say?
One of the songs that spoke to me back then was Monday, Monday by the Mamas and the Papas.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, a lot of the Peter, Paul, and Mary songs were very moving to me. I like the new Christy Minstrels. Their songs were more upbeat.
Sure, sure.
And there were a lot of songs, and of course one of the ones that I had R&R's in Bangkok. It seemed every bar I went to played "We Got to Get Out of This Place."
And
that's all the ones I remember. I mean, that time is sort of, there's parts of it I remember real well. Other parts are sort of vague now.
When it was "Hello Vietnam" in the movie, they were playing Madhavani in that. That wasn't going on.
No,
you were
no.
Did you hear "Crown Hour" by any chance?
No, not so far as I know. We did have AFVN, both radio and television. We actually did have
that's Armed Forces.
Armed Forces, exactly, and. They play pretty good music, but I don't remember any particular problem.
But they played like the Miracles.
And the Mamas and the
Papas.
And
all that.
You know, all. Interestingly enough, I don't recall them playing a lot of country and western, even though many of our troops were from that part of the country.
No, I don't remember them playing that.
Yeah,
either.
Me either.
I was going to say, you mentioned Armed Forces Television, which I always thought was very humorous to watch, because every night it seemed that the Hogan's Heroes was the program that was on all the time.
At that time? That was
Hogan's Heroes was shown on Armed Forces Radio every time. And, you know, you're looking at POWs and you're going, what is this weird program that they're showing to us? And I can't remember. I don't even remember. I think Lawrence Welk was probably another biggie at the time. But it was, you know, there wasn't, well, we didn't have any options. There was Vietnamese television. But, of course, we didn't understand what they were doing.
I mean that.
With soap operas. I knew that you could tell that they were soap operas, but, you know, of course, we had no idea what they were saying.
One of the things my late father did was I was a big Star Trek fan. And that was not anything. That was not on AFVN. But what he would do is he would tape, you know, audio tape the Star Trek episodes.
Oh, sure.
And send
them
to me. I still have some of them. It was a very touching thing for him to do.
Getting back to your experiences going out on missions, etc., I was watching the Heroes Channel, and they were talking about Lancaster bombers, World War II, the pilots and the crews, and after they flew their missions, now, folks, they lose 15% to 20% of their flight, of their mission. And they come back and eat breakfast. What did you do, Frank, when you came back from a mission? After you were briefed, then what did you do?
Well, if it was just a normal ash and trash kind of mission, a lot.
What did you call it?
Ash and trash.
What is that?
Well, it's you drop the H and add something else, and that's what we really called it. But it was ash and trash was just hauling logistics for, like Dale has already mentioned, you know, animals to cargo to people, whatever it was. You know, that was a log mission. Logged in our flight logs is either log missions or combat assault CAs.
Mm-hmm.
And if we were doing combat assaults, we could do combat assaults in the morning and log missions in the afternoon, or we could do combat assaults.
What did you do after?
Well, we got back in. My job was to just post
flight beer. And
I wasn't a drinker back then, so I had other alternatives which I made use of. Yeah.
Well, whatever.
What was available, right?
We won't go into that one, folks, so put your pencils down. We got the delay switch, right, Derek? Okay. What did you do after a flight?
Well,
you need to go to sleep, write letters?
Pretty much. I mean, it was kind of weird. It was, our day was almost a standard day. We would take off at 6 in the morning and usually be back by 5 in the afternoon, unless we had a night mission or something like that. So if we were just doing it ash and trash, as he was saying, you'd come back, you'd debrief the crew. Was anything broken? We'd have to write in a logbook if something was broken or it didn't work or we had a vibration or whatever. The crew chief would go over the aircraft. Usually they would wash it down. And then No, they did.
Oh, okay. That sounds good. I did. Yeah.
I did. Yeah. Give a baby a bath.
I was going to say.
Not every day. Sometimes, you know, very rarely did the I can't say it, talk for all the pilots, depending on where you were stationed probably, but most of the time they did that. We would go back. The officers and enlisted personnel didn't mingle much off the flight line, and so we would go to the officers club and they would go to the EM club and do whatever they did.
So you pretty much, I mean, your adrenaline wasn't so jumping around that you...
Sometimes it would take a while to come down, but
so what would you do then? I mean, probably. Have a drink or meditate. No, I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I want to know what you did.
No, well, there were movies every night in the company area. And it was always
this was after a mission. You're going to go to a movie.
Yeah, you take a six-pack of beer in your lawn chair.
There we go,
and
folks. A six-pack of beer.
You drag the same chair out there, and you watch the Green Berets.
And you've just been on a mission.
Over again. And you've just been on a mission. And so you'd go back, and somebody might ask, what happened on the mission? Do I want to fly there tomorrow? You know, that type of stuff. But after that, you'd just have a couple of beers and go to bed.
What time would you go to bed?
Well, you had to get up. They would come and wake you up at 5.
They would wake you up. So what time?
So you were probably in bed by 10 or 11.
Was it quiet?
No.
The hum of generators all the time.
Yeah, generators,
like, you know, always humming.
I don't know about you, but I'm having a flashback when I came back into the parking lot out here. I kept hearing these generators.
Oh.
And I'm going, what is all this noise about?
Yeah.
But generators were going all the time. Aircraft were running up and down because they had to fix, they had to repair them overnight to be ready to go the next morning. And so we didn't sleep that far away from the maintenance.
Wow. Okay. We got 30 seconds right here on Coolarity LLC, WAAM 1600 on the AM dial. We're going to veteransradio.net and we're going to be right back. And there's a little bit of this out music. So don't go away. We've got the news and some other great stuff. Take care. We'll be right back.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans' Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans' Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
In this dirty old part of the city, where the sun refuses to shine, people tell me there ain't no use in trying. Now, my girl, you're so young and pretty, and one thing I know is true, you'll be dead before.
We got to get out of this place. And you know what, folks? There's a little bit of singing going on here in the studio. I got a feeling that was the song of songs, eh?
That was it.
And when did you start singing that? Day one or after you've been in a month? Or
All the time.
Right. And I'm sure that you were counting the days because it was dangerous. It was dangerous.
No, but you knew how many days you had.
Right. But they're all right. Somebody, tell me, what was some good stuff? What was, the country was beautiful, or the, something?
The country was beautiful. The DMZ, at which I flew on, was part of my area of operation, AO, was so fantastically beautiful. I can't begin to tell you. Right after the monsoon season, the rivers up there were just overwhelmed. Just pounding the rocks. The rocks there are very similar to the rocks that are like out in Prescott, Arizona. Just these huge boulders, and the water was just pounding over them, going to the ocean. And some of the most ruggedly beautiful country I have ever seen in my life.
I'd go along with that. I was at Cameron Bay basically my entire tour, And it's a wonderful natural harbor. It's an incredible natural harbor. I'm surprised it isn't a resort destination nowadays. But there was a big mountain on the peninsula called Tiger Mountain. Supposedly, at some point, there had been somebody seen a tiger on it. I think maybe that was like 5,000 years ago. But anyway, that's why it was named Tiger Mountain. There were beautiful sand beaches. And
did you swim?
Yes. Yeah. We had a place called South Beach where you could go on the South China Sea where you could go swimming. And they had a little snack bar there. And I mostly worked nights. And so I would sometimes, as soon as I got off duty, I'd eat breakfast, which was, in my case was my dinner, then sack out for about 6 hours. Then I'd often hitchhike down to the South China Sea, the South Beach.
But this was all in protected territory.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, these guys saw a lot more stuff than I did. But, hey, the Army sent me where I did, and I did my job there.
Oh, absolutely. No.
That's what I was saying. We couldn't have done our job without what he was doing in his job.
Right.
Well, speaking, okay.
What?
We got to get out of this place. But you volunteered for them. Did you volunteer, Frank?
I did.
And you volunteered.
Well, ROTC, yes. In effect, I volunteered. And I was very happy to get out of Fort Bragg. Vietnam was a pleasure compared to Fort Bragg.
Because?
My commander was insane.
Nobody's
we
perfect.
We won't go there.
Huh?
Nobody's perfect.
Right. No, I actually...
they all seem a little meshuggah, though.
He was... I shouldn't be critical of him because... He did focus on the mission. Our mission was to train raw recruits and give them a shot at surviving in Vietnam. And I think he did do that, but he treated the rest of his staff, and it was equal opportunity. He hated everybody but himself, and he treated all of us like dirt. But at least it was fair. It didn't matter if you were black or white or enlisted or an officer. As long as you were below him, you were at the bottom of his, well, you know what type of list I'm talking about. But he did train up the troops. I'll give him that.
Okay, I'm going to take a little moment here or two and go in a little bit more depth with our guests. And Frank wrote the book, Ghost Riders, A War Story. What's 644? That's on the cover.
644 was the serial number of the UH-1 that I flew. That was an H model. It was actually 17-644. It was built. The 17 signified it was built in 1967. And 644 was the 644th helicopter built in 1967. And that was my helicopter.
From Da Nang to the DMZ, from the Anglo Bridge to the Osha Valley. Did you know all those places, Dale?
Not while I was there, because I was down south.
Okay.
Mine was from the Fish Hook to the Parrot's Beak to, you know, the Plain of Reeds to Fung Tau.
Okay, Ghost Riders. You published it. How can somebody get, this is a great book, folks. And first of all, summertime reading, but look at the font. Isn't that great?
Bob's very taken by big font that we can read nowadays.
Okay, all those out there that like big fonts, raise your hand. See that, Dale? Look how many. There's thousands of them.
I wanted to remind people that they can get this book through the Veterans Radio website. If you go on there and let us know, and we'll get you an autograph copy of Ghost Riders. And I would like, this is my little ego thing, that I was in the 2nd Platoon of the 195th Assault Helicopter Company, and we were also known as the Ghost Riders.
Cue that up, Nina, right? We'll get that in just a second. And you wrote this book. Why did you write this? I mean, everybody, well, I wrote it because I... But was there anything in particular why you wrote this book?
Well, the quick story is that I started in diary form for both of my children because my children have lived a very privileged life, and I wanted them, as they were approaching their 19th year of age, to be able to relate to what I was doing as their father when I was 19. And as I continued to write it out in diary form, it started to evolve into a story, and then I just thought, well, you know what, there might be other people that might like to read this, and then it did evolve as a story, and that's how it came to fruition. But I had the right, the need to write that ever since Vietnam. It just took me 25, 30 years to get it going. Mm-hmm. So.
And you purged. I mean, was it cathartic?
Actually, no. It was. It actually hurt a little bit because some of the stuff in there.
Oh, I know.
Is you relive it to write it, and I didn't really want to relive it anymore. And I guess maybe you could say it was cathartic, but not. There was one area of one chapter that I just had to wait until almost the end of the book to finish.
Tell us about that.
Well, we were. It was. We'd already had. A couple of people killed in combat assaults in our company, so death was now a rational thing, and we had not experienced that prior. And we went into an LZ, a landing zone, that was the worst LZ, worst approach I've ever seen in my life. And we were, to go to the bottom line, five helicopters went in on the first day, and three were shot down or had blade strikes. On this LZ, and so they shut
the
LZ.
What's a blade strike?
Hits a tree. We hit a tree.
Oh.
I mean, it was the margins were
really tight.
Insignificant. Very insignificant. Tight, yeah. They were, between me and my door gunner, we were calling clearances. We weren't even shooting. We were more worried about getting a blade strike going down. That's how narrow the margin was on the assault.
Come in
through
three, in the drop
a triple
zone.
Canopy. Yeah. Triple canopy, yeah, of jungle.
What's triple canopy?
Three layers of growth of jungle trees. The upper canopy would be the top canopy, first canopy. Then you had that mid-level canopy and then a lower canopy. And so we were less than a foot of margin on either side with the rotor blades for a 600-foot hover, which is, it took a 19, 20, 21-year-old boy to be able to do that kind of stuff, to have that mm-hmm. that dexterity. But anyway, they were shooting at us. It was a hot LZ. We were getting shot at. And as we descended through it, three of the helicopters, well, the first one went in, got shot down. The second one went in, had a blade strike. I was the third helicopter in, so now there's already two down, and nobody's made it out. So we were concerned about rotor tolerance, blade tolerance, and as far as those strikes. So we got down, and when we got into the opening of the LZ, it was a quagmire of nastiness. I mean, there was the trees were, it was an artillery LZ that just totally blown out, and our guys jumped. On my side of the helicopter, there was probably about a 25 foot jump with 80, 90 pounds on their back. And I didn't even have to tell them to go. As soon as we stopped descending, they were gone. I mean, they just jumped into this stuff. Can you imagine it?
Mm-hmm. Nina, hit it.
An old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Up on a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, plowing through the ragged sky, and up a cloudy draw. Their brands were still on fire, and their hooves were made of steel. Their horns were black and shiny, and their hot breath he could feel. A bolt of fear went through him as they thundered through the sky. For he saw the riders coming hard, and he heard their mournful cry. Yippee-i-oh, yippee-i-oh, ghost riders in the sky.
Had to get that in.
Oh, yeah, folks. Did you hear it? Yeah, we got that all in. Dale, you talked about blade strikes when you and I have had private.
Yeah, I mean, when you were occasionally we would have to try and land in an LZ where we had to go down through the three layers of jungle cover, and sometimes it had blown apart, and sometimes you kind of had to maneuver your way around to get to the ground. And when you got to the ground, it's almost black. It was so dark. I don't know. You know, my admiration, and I'm sure Frank's is the same, for these guys, these infantrymen that would jump out at 25 feet with 80 to 90 pounds of equipment, or jump out of a helicopter when everybody else is shooting at you, and they go off into the woods to try and, you know, take care of the bad guys. I don't know where they got the, you know, the guts to do that stuff. And I was always admiring the bravery that they have. And then they come back and they say, oh, thank you very much for taking us out of here. And we're going, you know, we take them in, we take them out. And that was, it turned out to be a lot more meaningful after I got home. I didn't realize what I was doing.
Yeah, the infantry, in my opinion, have my utmost respect. I have never seen, and I'll even get emotional over this, but I have never seen young American boys who were so selfless in, I mean, they were trying to survive too, because they didn't want to be on that helicopter any longer than they had to, but to jump into the poop holes that they were jumping into or dropping them off in, and there was never a lack of bravery, ever. I mean, the guys that the Army is putting out today, the Marines, all the military forces, have the same dedication and direction that, unfortunately, and I'm going to get on a soapbox here, but unfortunately, America does not appreciate.
I think
they
do. I think they do. And that's not to argue. I do. And because I see so many examples. Dale, where were we at the restaurant when the guy said thank you for your service?
Well, yeah, but
that's because you brought him coffee.
No,
wait.
No, but I agree with Frank on this. I don't think that the vast majority of America appreciates what their servicemen do. I think there's a lot of lip service.
Yeah.
Could I tell a story that happened to me at Costco, which I found quite moving, actually? It was a World War II veteran. You could tell from the hat. And so we were both leaving, and I stopped him, and I said, may I thank you for your service, sir? And he said, well, thank you. And he said, I'll bet you're ex-military. And I said, yes, sir, I'm retired. And he said, Vietnam? And I said, yes, sir. And at that point, another guy, probably 40 years old, you know, I was 70 at the time, comes up, and he said, I'd like to thank both of you for your service. That was really touching.
Well, we're seeing more of that, and I don't know, maybe it's always 2 degrees.
Well, I really think that the reason you're seeing...
I mean, American Sniper was, and Patton was a great movie, and American Sniper and Private Ryan. And.
But the reason this thank you for your service has evolved is because of Vietnam veterans.
Yes.
You know, the shame that the American public put on the American soldier coming home from Vietnam is manifest in the fact that they don't ever want to do that again, because it was the politicians' war. It wasn't our war. We did what the politicians told us to do. And because of that, today's GI gets the respect he's well deserved, because of what we suffered as Vietnam vets. Suffering is might be the in not the right word, but
experienced, sure.
Right? And so I think as far as my legacy goes, and Dale's and Mike's, you know, we opened the doors
to
the respect.
You did your job,
man. Yeah, and the guys today that are out there doing it deserve all the respect.
How old were you, Frank?
I was 20 when I came home.
21.
Yeah.
Well, you know, another thing that happened along what you're talking about, Frank, I was in Hobby Lobby, and there was a woman with a young child in front of me, and the kid was only about 3 or 4 years old, I think, but he had fatigue pants on. And he looks at me, and he says, hello, and you know, I said, hello back, and I said, you know, I used to wear pants like that. So this little kid says, were you a soldier? And I said, well, yes, I was. This woman turned around and said, he's a superhero. And so I said, not maybe to break the mood. I said, well, actually, ma'am, I was a military lawyer. But anyway, she said, you're still a hero. Don't you think that didn't make my day?
It sure did. Made your day. Absolutely. You did your job. We all did our job.
That's right. You didn't need to. You didn't need to be a grunt or an infantryman to show that you did your job.
Every guy that
supported that grunt in the field did his job.
And when you're Army, what is your base? 1-1-1. We were all infantrymen when we first started and went through basic training. We were all 1-1-1. So we all have that team building, and that is. You know, I guess I just can't say enough about the teamwork that I experienced, and I'm sure with all three of you, especially in such a time of need where your whole well-being is at stake.
Yeah, I mentioned that one colonel that gave me a hard time at Fort Bragg, but there were other people that I respect to this day. It was my honor to serve for a fellow who was later became a lieutenant general. And who invited me to his retirement ceremony. Tell me that made my day. But, you know, I was reasonably successful as a lawyer in civilian life, but I really owe it to one of my commanders in the reserves, because he really taught me about work and work ethic, and how if people depend on you, you have to perform.
Hire the veteran, man. Dale, you armed your slick Huey with Hawk missiles.
No,
didn't have the Hawk?
No. We didn't.
Or
we
you called them Hawk.
We had no missiles.
No, you called them Hawk. What's this Hawk business?
I don't know. Yeah.
All right, Mike.
Yeah, okay, well.
Now, wait a minute. Let me set the tone here, folks. We were sending, they'd come in cylinders, right? How long were they?
They were like this, about the size of, an old Japanese pickup truck, one of the first small ones, put it about half size.
And like a Datsun.
Yeah, something like that. But anyway, we had...
Were they that big around?
They were pretty big. We had, at Cameron Bay, we had a Hawk missile battery. Or a battalion, excuse me. They had two batteries. And they had these... They were surface-to-air missiles. And they were designed for short-range defense of Cameron Bay. You know, they probably, in retrospect, as far as I know, they never fired a shot in anger because... The North Vietnamese didn't have much of a long-range air force. But anyway, they were there, and their missiles were shipped in these pressurized containers. And
get this, folks.
Yeah.
Pressure.
And
I mean, did they have gauges on them?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they had a pressure gauge.
What was the pressure for?
Well, because they had, for the day, remember, this is 67, 68, they still had very sophisticated guidance systems. You know, you just don't fire the thing. It's got to, you fire it, but then it's got to get lock onto its target and then hopefully blow the target out of the sky. Otherwise, it'll be like World War II. You're not going to hit anything. Well, so periodically, something would go wrong, and rather than try and fix them on the spot, they would retrograde them to the state, and then you'd get a replacement. And they would come through our ammo battalion. And I swear, every blankety-blank time we had to do one of those, something bad would happen. Either a forklift would put its tines through the container, or the one that was absolutely classic, they dropped it off the back of a deuce and a half. When I say dropped, I mean crash. Anyway, the truck driver says, well, I don't think it's really damaged. I remember saying, no, I think we can assume it's not going to be being fired anytime soon.
All right, we've got about 6 minutes, right? How are we doing? Okay, we've got about 6 minutes, and I know our listeners would like to hear this, hear these comments about to come out. That, okay, you get conditioned to circumstances, and you were conditioned to your environment being there for at least a year, and that doesn't just quite go away. But I think there's a double-edged sword to it. You can't ever hit that level of excitement again, the adrenaline. I'm not talking about that you've got to go rob a 7-Eleven, but to get your adrenaline pumping. And, you know, your body sort of craves that, does it not? I'm got All right, I'm only seeing one shaking head right now. Frank, why don't we start with you?
Well,
I mean, when you came back to civilian life, what in the world? Of course, Frank flies jets, folks, but...
Well, it wasn't coming back to civilian life. It was the adrenaline rush is I've only experienced it in Vietnam, and it's an incredible high. I mean, it's just an incredible high, and I really don't even know what to say. It's one of those things that
when you came back, was it that it still? I don't want to say flashbacks, but did you feel that energy was still there?
I missed it.
That's what I wanted to
say. I missed it. Yeah.
Dale, what about you?
I think the, as Frank pointed out, is that you don't. It's so hard to explain because you're never going to get that excited about something ever in your life.
Hopefully.
I think one of the
I bet your wife loves that.
I'll hear about that one. But the
Jane.
But the point was is that at 20 years old you've done this. And the World War II guys did the same thing and the Korean guys and all these other, you know, you come home, you're 20 years old, 21 years old, whatever it is. The next question is, now what? What do I do next? You know, there a lot of veterans, you know, do crazy things. They do. They take on dangerous jobs. They take, they do the motorcycle thing. They do all the stuff that many of us did. And
that's where the Hell's Angels from after World War II.
You know, is that you're trying to figure out how to match that excitement level legally, and it's difficult to do. So you know, maybe we played sports, or maybe we played something else just to keep that going because it's just.
And it is physiological. It really is there. There's a bar body.
Yeah, I think that you're hooked on trying to do something exciting. So many guys took risks. That's the thing. You know, you take risk with your life because heck, I'm invincible. Look, I just survived Vietnam. I think I'll go mountain climbing next, or skydiving, or something along those lines. And I think a lot of guys tried to do that and. Some of them paid, some of them couldn't do that, so they turned to other activities. Even the veterans coming home today, you know, they can't cope with that sudden stop of adrenaline, and they'll do something else or try something else.
Well, in my case...
Mike,
you
got about a minute.
Okay, well, you know, my career was a little unusual in that I had the 2 years of active duty in the 60s, and then another year of active duty in the 1990s.
Right. But you were in charge of ammunition, of ordnance, right. Of bullets, of napalm, of you had to have pallets of things. So all that responsibility.
It was a lot. And I will tell you this, that the two times I was on active duty for an extended period of time, 67, 68, and again in 90, 91, were the two most exciting, challenging times of my life.
In our time, what do we got? 1 minute? That's it? 1 minute. Oh, a minute and a half. Okay. Final word, Frank?
It was a overwhelming, growing...
And don't forget your book. Promote your book.
It was an overwhelming, growing experience in Vietnam. I wrote about my year there as a crew chief and the trials and tribulations of combat and being a human being.
That's great, folks. It's called Ghost Riders, a war story. Frank Lampi, L-A-M-P-I, 1 minute, Dale.
Let us know. It was the best of times and it was the worst of times, to quote a famous
best job author. I ever had.
Yeah, it was. It was a great job.
I do it all over again and twice on Sunday.
You know, that's it. Dale, I think you said that once when we first started partnering together. It's the most defining moment of your life.
Absolutely.
Being in the service. No, but whether it was combat or just did your job, and that's why when you do meet a vet, it's instant, right? Y'all been there. Okay. Next week, Dale is going to be doing a 4th of July, and Nina says 22nd. So you're going to want to come back to Veterans Radio.
Right, come back next Sunday, 5 to 6.
5 to 6.
4th of July. Happy birthday, America.
Until then, you are dismissed.